Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Macon Frye, author of They Called Us River Rats, The Last Bachelor Settlement of New Orleans, and poet Tiana Nobile, whose new collection is called Cleave. It is a real pleasure to welcome Macon Frye to The Reading Life. Macon is a writer and educator who lives in a self-built house on the Mississippi River Batcher. He's the author of a wonderful book, The Cajun Country Guide, and in his fascinating new book, They Called Us River Rats, The Last Batcher Settlement of New Orleans, he chronicles the life of his chosen outsider community in one of the most unusual of New Orleans neighborhoods. Macon Frye, congratulations on this book and welcome.
Well, thank you, Susan. It's really great to talk to you today.
Now, you're a longtime resident of the Mississippi River Batcher, but even before that, you were in love with what you call river life.
Yes. I have always loved rivers. I spent a lot of time growing up on a river in Virginia, the Rappahannock River, another big, broad river.
So tell us the story of how you got your first home on the New Orleans Batcher, Rob Shack, which is sort of being in the right place at the right time in a real New Orleans way.
Yeah, I got to New Orleans, and of course one of the big attractions when I moved here, beyond the food and the music and everything else that brings people to New Orleans, was the river itself. And I shared the same surprise that many people do, that the river really, at that time, was only visible from a very few points in town. And I had to work to take time each day to get up over the levee and enjoy the river. And one night, I met a guy down here at the Maple Leaf Bar, a watering hole that many people be familiar with in uptown New Orleans. And I met a guy that was telling, he was expounding on all sorts of conspiracy theories. And he said, I introduced myself and bought him a beer, and he asked where I grew up, and I told him, well, more or less on the Rappahannock River in Virginia. And he said, I live on the river here. So that I could hardly believe. I had lived here for 3 years writing about music and the culture in the city and had never heard of anyone living on the river, much less imagine my surprise when Rob said, well, come on up. I'll show you the place. It was walking distance from where I lived, from the Maple Leaf. So we dumped our beers and go cups and came up, walked up Oak Street and walked up the side of the levee. And there, you know, in the willow trees with fog blowing in, and it was almost mystical to arrive at this place at this time, were 12 camps up on stilts, right on the bank of the river, on the riverside of the levee. And that's how I found it. Sooner or later would have had to have found it, because now they've built a bike path here and people are beginning to discover the place. But that was a moment of revelation.
And since then, it's been a good life, but a lot of work. It's hard to live on the Batcher.
Well, it's hard. But, you know, one of the great things about living on the Batcher, at least for me, since I am not the most skilled of Batcher dwellers, is that it's been a place that's allowed me to fail and catch myself before I floated away, shall we say, many times. You know, I built a house here, but before I did that, I tried to jack up a house and I dropped it. And I took up fishing here and nearly drowned on my first few exploits, but now I catch fish in the river all spring. So it's been a place that has taught a lot of lessons and allowed me to learn them the hard way, shall we say.
A real river education. I mean, right. I'm glad you survived it. Now, there's really something for everyone in this book. For the lover of great nature writing, there's an exquisite chapter about the flora and fauna along the Badger, and the fish and the river shrimp and all the other species to be found in what you call the wet pantry.
Right. You know, the things that I've learned since I've been on the river have been multitudinous, but really some of the greatest surprises have been things that I've found just walking out the door and exploring this side of the levee, because so many things wash up and grow and proliferate and change season to season mm-hmm. on the bank of the river here. So things that that I never knew were here, oyster mushrooms and the size of the catfish we catch.
Yes.
How plentiful they are. But I think that probably most remarkable to me as a person that's really deeply into the food culture of New Orleans was discovering the river shrimp. And I didn't know that such a thing existed until I found an old shrimp trap in the camp here where that I purchased on the bank of the river, and discovered that this shrimp trap, that the shrimping had been a thing on the river for centuries, that since probably the late 1700s, certainly early 1800s, people were catching shrimp in the river. And the shrimp that they were catching were the original culinary shrimp of New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
So if you went to Arnaud's or one of the great old line historical restaurants of New Orleans and ordered shrimp in the 1800s, there was a strong likelihood that you would be getting, in fact, you would certainly be getting initially river shrimp, because there weren't trawlers and there weren't big offshore vehicles catching jumbo Gulf shrimp. All there were people with traps and nets that were catching shrimp in the river. And so that was really a revelation that those shrimp are here, much like the Badger dwellers, much like the people that have lived on the river. Those creatures are still living here on the flooded shore, unrecognized to most people in the city.
Now, beyond just your little strip of the Badger, mm-hmm. there's the history, the larger history of the Badger's relationship with the city. And you write about other waterfront communities that you care about, like those along Lake Pontchartrain.
It's really interesting what's happened to the riverfronts here. And I don't try to think about it in overtly political terms, but certainly there's a sense that these communities along our waterways, and they existed all up and down the Mississippi, but one of the biggest was right where I live in New Orleans on the Badger. But those on the lake also, there's a sense that those places are outside of the levees. They're outside of these walls that the city has built to protect itself. And that's the physical situation, the part that makes the communities largely invisible. But there's also a sense that these places are beyond the pale in a very literal and a figurative way. If the pale, as in palisades, as in fencing, mm-hmm. if the pale is the Badger, then when the levee builders built these levees, they actually created a space, and they actually named the space on the riverside of the levee outside the levees. And if you think about it, there's no reason why the levees were holding the river in. It could have been inside the levee here, but almost in their very wording, they created outsider communities, not just this one,
mm-hmm.
but a numerous community sprung up of people that were willing to or wanted to live outside the pale, so to speak.
Now, you tell the stories of how Badger residents have survived storms and floods, and I was so fascinated by how you came through Hurricane Katrina.
The thing about Hurricane Katrina that I think more and more people are actually aware of now is that the city flooded from the lake.
Right.
So you wouldn't take it for granted that anything on the Badger, where I live, which is across the levee from the city on the riverside, you wouldn't take it for granted that there would have been flooding here during Katrina. But it was a remarkable event here as it was everywhere else in the city because, A, it demonstrated the fact that really the river is the high ground in the city of New Orleans because we didn't flood. But also, the night before the storm, I came home from a day of working, and I hadn't paid any attention to the weather. The Hurricane Katrina was a blip on the weather map. At the point in time, I started my project building gardens that morning. And then by the time I got home, all my volunteers had left with their wives screaming at them and saying, what are you doing building gardens? Come, we've got to leave town. So I was left alone to put my supplies away at 10 at night and tied them underneath the camp here, wheelbarrows and shovels, and came inside. And it must have been about 10 o'clock. It was starting to rain and wind was coming in. I turned on the last weather report that I watched for probably a month and saw that this storm was supposed to come in. And interestingly, you seldom get this in a weather report, but the weatherman said, and the Mississippi River is expected to crest at 14 feet. So what that means in a graphic sense, 14 feet, the river at that time was at 2 feet above Gulf level. It's right where you would expect it in the fall, way out in front of the camps. We had a sand beach under the house, and
wow,
our camps sit up on stilts. So I would not have had any cause to be worried about anything. My house is probably about 19 or 20 feet above sea level. But with the river crossing at 14 feet, that meant that all the wheelbarrows and shovels and tools and other things that people here store under their house, so that it doesn't look like hillbilly heaven. People just throw stuff under their house. Well, all of that stuff had to be moved or it would have been wrecked by the waves that would be under my house. So I had to pick all that stuff up. And sure enough, the next morning, the river was up under my house. And by noon, the river was right back where it was 12 hours beforehand. So in a period of 12 hours, that storm pushed a surge up the river as far as New Orleans that was a 12-foot surge. I mean, by anybody's definition, that's like a tsunami.
Now, for the lover of the Mississippi River, there's a lot of lore in this book. You've done a lot of reading and thinking about this particular river.
The great mystery of the whole place to me, not just this settlement, but like the other places here, is how little information I could find about these watery places for so long. And it was a great mystery to me. How did these places get to be here? And why doesn't anybody know about them? And the first thing that a light bulb went off at some point in my research where I realized the reason these places are unknown and undescribed is because they are river places. And so histories of the city, they're not writing about places that are and people that are on the other side of the levee. I think that it was probably when I was reading about the settlement of the place and realized that the people that settled here, yes, people came over from the city, eccentrics and kooks and adventurous people came over and lived on this side of the levee. But the first people that lived here were people that came down the river from Ohio, from down the Ohio River and and points on the Appalachian frontier and floated down the river and settled here on their boats. And then there was the moment in time where the boats grew legs.
Well, I am very glad you told the tale for all of us and added to Mississippi River stories. We've been talking with Macon Frye, whose new book is They Called Us River Rats, The Last Bachelor Settlement of New Orleans. You can meet him Saturday, May 22nd, from noon to 2:30 at Octavia Books. Macon, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan. Great to talk with you.
Tiana Nobile is a Korean-American adoptee who grew up in Massapequa Park on Long Island. Now she lives in New Orleans. She is a Kundiman Fellow, the recipient of a Rona Jaffe Foundation Writers Award, and a finalist in the National Poetry Series. She is the author of one chapbook, The Spirit of the Staircase, and this month we celebrate the arrival of her first full collection, Cleave. Tiana Nobile, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
I'm so happy to have you here for this extraordinary book. But first, tell us a little bit about how you ended up in New Orleans.
Sure, yeah. I came to New Orleans for the first time when I was in college. And after that first trip, I just kept coming back. Every opportunity I had, I just really couldn't stay away. So when I graduated undergrad, I knew that I didn't want to stay in New York. It was too fast and too expensive. So I thought, why not New Orleans? And that was 12 years ago, and I'm still here.
It just pulls you in sometimes, doesn't it? It's really.
Yeah.
Oh, tell us the adoption story that's behind this book. This is a book that's deeply, deeply personal for you.
I started writing the poems that ultimately made the book in undergrad. And I think initially was writing very much like around adoption. I noticed in retrospect later that I was writing a lot just about kind of the disembodied self or ghosts and haunting. And it wasn't until later that I realized that I kept pointing to my adoption or skirting around it. And then I studied with Kathy Park Hong, who is a Korean-American poet, essayist. In her class, I just finally had the courage to really dive into the meat of that experience in a way that I never was able to before. I think through the process of writing the book, I finally gave myself permission to take some ownership over my own story, because there's so much about adoption narratives that are told by primarily adoptive parents and adoption agencies that you hear so little from the perspective of the adoptee, even less so from the biological family's perspective. So to take some autonomy and agency back for myself through the process of writing these poems was just incredibly empowering and also very difficult, for sure.
Oh, of course, of course. So cleave is one of those words with a dual meaning. You know, it can mean cling to or it can mean sever from. But it's the perfect word for the story you're telling in this book.
Yeah, exactly. I find words, these kind of like lexical paradoxes, to be so intriguing. I got my MFA at Warren Wilson College, and at my first residency, because it's a low residency program, the director of the program, Deborah Albury, gave a lecture on cleave, on this idea of a word containing both itself and its opposite. And it's just something that sat with me for a really long time. And the book actually had another title at in a previous iteration, and a friend of mine was like, that's not the title. And I was like, oh, okay. So I had to like go find another title. And then I just kept on being pulled back to this lecture. And I think it just perfectly captures this idea of, especially as an adoptee, kind of clinging to something that's severing you or being compelled into something that's broken. It felt right.
Read us, if you would, the first poem in the book, which sort of sets the stage, and tell us about it, because you use real facts in these poems. You use real bits of history throughout the book. So this is a bit of your history that's included.
This poem is called Moon Young Shin, which is the Korean name I was given that I arrived with when I came to the United States. And you know, as a kid, this is a name that I really resisted because I think it was a constant reminder that I was someone else before I was me, or that I was supposed to be someone else. So in lots of ways, writing this poem helped me reclaim my Korean name and to think of it not as a relic of a past life, but really as an active part of who I am today. And how can I integrate it into who I am today?
Mm-hmm.
Moon Young Shin. Written on the white slip at the bottom of a Polaroid cut off by the frame, a name. Many years passed before I learned surnames come first in Korea. I rode my bicycle in circles around this reversal. For years, my skin leaped from shadow to shadow. I drank the darkness, or the darkness drank me, but what's the difference when your veins are full of haunting? One day I will walk the narrow streets of many cities full of ice freshly frozen. I will hike through forests of windstorms newly risen. I will learn and forget the names of many trees, of tea leaves plucked too early in the season. I will orbit the earth like a moon, searching for its shadow. Where does a moon find its planet? Or is it the other way around? To be a recently hatched egg moon, curved shell pinned to the sky, I spent my whole life in orbit of other people's light, celestial satellite in ceaseless wane. How much can you learn from a stranger's surname? A young animal crawls its way out of the womb, stretches its legs, and feels cold for the very first time.
I love that poem. Now, you're writing directly into the face of current events with this book and your first. Your first book was issue-based and deeply personal in Spirit of the Staircase. And this was a chapbook you did with artist Bridget Conroy that addressed prejudice against Asian American and Pacific Islanders. Talk a little bit about that project as a lead up to this one.
Sure. Yeah, that was a series of poems that I had written over the course of a few years. So I had this note in my iPhone where anytime somebody would say something to me that struck me, I would just write it down. These could be, you know, microaggressions, like, where are you really from? Or they could be more macro and sometimes aggressive. The list just would grow and grow and grow. And for a long time, I wasn't quite sure what to do with it. And then I learned about the concept Spirit of the Staircase, which comes from a French idiom, which basically is the idea that, say, somebody says something to you, and in the moment, you just don't know what to say, whether you're kind of stunned or shocked or just speechless. And then as you're walking away down the stairs, so to say, you're overcome by the spirit of the staircase and you finally come up with that great comeback or reply. And often, even after years of people othering me or objectifying me or, you know, even attacking me verbally, I think still I never quite in the moment knew what to say or what to do. So through the course of writing the poem, again, similarly to the poems in Cleave, I felt like I finally had agency or the space to respond.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote these short prose poems to finally take some of that back. And then I partnered with Bridget, who's a dear friend. We went to college together, and she currently lives in New Orleans as well, and got to work on this beautiful project that Antenna published for us.
It's a beautiful book. It really is.
Yeah, I feel really proud of it. I think about that more as an art book. I feel like It's a couple of poems. It's really only 7 poems, but the work that Bridget put in to create these just gorgeous drawings and watercolors, I think them paired together, it's just such a special little collection.
Well, this work deals with, deals with one of the central facts of your life. And you've taken it and you've given it shape and meaning. And yet, you're going to be writing about this always, don't you think?
I know.
You know, there's so many ways to write about this. You can see organizing metaphors and shapes and narratives. But this has got to mean something special for the way you've put it together, included these ideas in this sequence. This is such a labor of self-examination, love. It's just complex in so many ways.
I was actually in another interview talking in conversation with Esteban Rodriguez, who's a poet, and he asked how I saw this book kind of being in conversation with work that is to come. And I think in many ways, I see it as just the root to a tree that has just begun to grow. And I'm working on a lyric essay that's about my first trip back to Korea, which I took 2 years ago. And it explores the relationship between water and the body and the history of mirrors. And I'm learning about mirrors and how mirrors are especially informed by the occult. And it's just really, again, I'm just like diving back into this whole research, but I definitely see the book informing the work that is to come and just serving as that foundation.
I love that, the tree that is about to grow. So It'll be a big, beautiful tree, I'm sure. Well, we've been talking with Tiana Nobile, whose exquisite new book is Cleave. Tiana, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Here in New Orleans, Macon Frye signs They Called Us River Rats, the last Batcher settlement of New Orleans, Saturday, May 22nd at a socially distant book signing from 12:30 to 2:30 p.m. at Octavia Books, and then appears again Sunday, May 23rd from 1 to 2:30 at Blue Cypress Books. Bethany Mangle is the guest at Virtual Happy Hour Monday, May 24th at 5, sponsored by Garden District Bookshop on Facebook Live and YouTube. Dr. James Ciaravella Jr. discusses in Signs Charity's Children, The Long Days and Nights of the Iron Men, Tuesday, May 25th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Tickets required in advance. Tiana Nobile reads from her new collection, Cleave, in a virtual event, also featuring Carolyn Hembry and Shana Monet, Thursday, May 27th at 6, sponsored by Octavia Books. OctaviaBooks.com for info. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellas Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.